All right, so just to finish up one last thing, we were talking yesterday about the idea with the refugees. So it's an interesting thing. There's a book that came out, you can find it in some of the Judaica shops, from time immemorial. It's a really fat book, pretty boring. I browsed through it. You know, I was not going to buy it. I browsed through it. It's really too long. But it was written by this woman, Joan Peters. Joan Peters worked for CBS, and she produced lots of documentaries, and she herself was the type of person that would fight the cause, and therefore she was a civil rights activist, and she, you know, dealt with the rights of the blacks in America, and she decided to write an expose about the mistreatment of the Arabs and the rights of the Palestinians to the land of Israel. And as she did her research, she started seeing that there are no rights to Palestinians. There are no Palestinians. They haven't been living here from time immemorial. That's the name of the title, as they claim. But rather, they only started coming back to Israel when the Jews started coming back and making the land flourish and creating jobs. There was no jobs here. There was nothing to do here. Nothing grew here. So there were very few Bedouins that just were living in Israel. But only when the Jews started coming back in the late 19th century, sort of building up the land, did Muslims start arriving in Israel looking for a better life. So it was interesting, like most interesting thing about our book is the introduction, is that she says, I started out with an agenda and I had to do an about face. It was exactly what I thought was 180 degrees. It's just, I was wrong. Like in a review of the book, a Jewish author, Saul Bellow, says, it's so interesting that all these people in the media think they have the facts, and they're talking as if they have the facts, and this book proves that they were all wrong. Everyone's saying all these things, and she did the research, like I said, very thorough research, and she said that there isn't just nothing to the claim. Okay. Now, what I had said yesterday was, after the War of Independence, and the Arabs start kicking out the Jews from their lands, the country now doubles in size in a few short years. And those years are difficult years. So I'm going to quote from this book. It's actually two different books that I highly recommend. Anyone ever hear of Herman Wouk? Herman Wouk is an Orthodox Jew. He just died recently, like at 106, something like that. He fought in World War II. And he's an Orthodox Jew who wrote a lot of books. He was a playwright for Broadway, the Caine Mutiny, a whole bunch of different awards, or War and Remembrance, I think, not the Caine Mutiny, War and Remembrance. He wrote a lot of different plays and books, and he wrote two historical fiction novels, one called The Hope, one called The Glory. The Hope is sort of like from 1947 to 1973, and then The Glory, 73 to the year 2000. And these, what was in historical fiction? He deals with all these historical events that actually happened, deals with all the people that, you know, took part in major events, but he creates fictional characters that happen to be there at the same time with them. So yeah, I mentioned this. So not everyone heard. So for example, he'll have some guy that's fighting in the War of Independence, right? Mohammed al-Shikhur, who then later on will become like, I don't know, like a major by the time we get to the Sinai War. Some other guy who will become like, is in politics and will make his way and will be like an ambassador in the United Nations. But he'll have people in all the places. Then by the time you get to the second book, a child of this guy will be in the raid in Entebbe. You know, and he'll be there with Yoni Netanyahu in Entebbe. This guy's with Ariel Sharon over here, and this guy's with Moshe Dayan over here. So you'll have real stuff. In the back, he talks about all the research and he quotes all the places that he did his research from. But he has these fictional characters, so you're getting attached to their lives, but they're all doing these cool things in these places, and some of the characters they weave with other fictional characters, but they're all getting this really panoramic view of Jewish history written in a novel form. So it's interesting and not just, you know, reading history, history, history. Anyway, here's in one chapter he writes as follows. Those years from 1949 to 1953 were the worst of times, Moshe Dayan writes in his memoirs. The army more or less fell apart. The scratched together force of incompatible militias plus reservists, draftees, immigrants, and foreign volunteers could cope better with Arabs, done with victory. Though impotent to fight on, the Arab governments would consider no treaty with the invisible country. Armistice brought no peace but siege. Terrorists called Fedayeen crossed ill-guarded borders to derail trains, burn buses, blow up buildings, murder unwary civilians. Housing, cars, clothes, food, and fuel were scarce. Life was shabby and precarious. Israelis left in droves for places like Canada and Los Angeles. In 1953, Dayan was appointed Army Chief of Staff, and he writes that then things began to improve.
1953.
Right, so in other words, from 49 to 53, it was terrible, until, of course, I took over, things got better. Those same 4 years, 1949 to 1953, were the best of times, David Ben-Gurion writes in his memoirs. Israel's heroic years, the greatest years in our history, since the Maccabee victory over the Greeks 2,300 years ago. Because in those 4 years, the Jewish population of Israel more than doubled. The wondrous return, the ingathering of the exile, the radiant core vision of Zionism began to come true. All around the Mediterranean, the frustrated Arab governments turned on the Jews and drove them out. And the beleaguered new Jewish state of 600,000 took in 700,000 refugees. It's really a remarkable thing. In 4 years, 600,000 took in 700,000 refugees. This happening, perhaps unprecedented in the history of the world, caused the shortages, the empty treasury, the black market, the rationing, the disillusionment of the faint-hearted Israel. Nevertheless, survived and even flourished until, in 1953, David Ben-Gurion resigned as Prime Minister and Defense Minister. Then he writes, things began to deteriorate. Deteriorate so badly, in fact, that in 1955, the latter call up to power, and none too soon. Okay? Two men, two different views, obviously a little bit biased by who they are, but they both paint the portrait of the difficulty, but at the same time, the amazing, momentous achievements that occurred in these difficult times. So I want to just point out some major things that happened in these early years. So first of all, 1949, Theodor Herzl. What does he rename? Benjamin Zev. Benjamin Zev Herzl is reinterred in Eretz Israel. He had been buried in Vienna. He had left message that when the state is formed, he knew it's going to happen. He wants to be buried in Israel, and he was. He and his parents. His parents had, they were very wealthy, and they were benefactors, and they helped him in his endeavor.
Why was he buried in Vienna?
There was no Israel that you could get into yet. Right? He died at the age of 44. Theodor Herzl died at the age of 44. He gave his life to the Jewish people. He continued. He worked tirelessly. He got sick and he kept going. And he pushed through and he died at a very young age. His wife, it's sort of weird. I was now looking up a little bit. I'll get to you in a second. She was very bitter. Because she lost her husband to Zionism. She was never home. He drained the family assets for nationalistic causes. She married this wealthy guy. She was in Vienna. She went to opera. She wore nice clothes. And all of a sudden, it was gone. So she was jealous. And she basically despised Zionism. And when she died, the Zionists wrote like all this nice stuff about her, how she was in her husband's corner, and how she backed him, you know, because, well, she wanted to make it sound, but like, it was not true. Like, he wrote all these letters to his parents, and we have letters that he wrote to her saying we should split up, and like, whatever. So she ended up, she's never reinterred. Truth is, she was actually cremated. They could have even brought that, whatever, nothing. So he's buried here, his parents are buried in Har Herzl, they renamed Har Herzl after him. All these big ceremony, the airport, all the heads of state came, the army generals, dignitaries, and like I said, it was called Har Menuchot. Now it's called Har Herzl after him, and Har Herzl is the state's cemetery. Like, you know, other than Begin, I think all prime ministers are buried there. Begin had left instructions, he wanted to be buried near these two people from the Irgun who gave their life, you know, for the Irgun. Like, Begin's like different. And it's the place where, like, most, many, anyway, soldiers are buried there who were killed in battle. Okay, again, if you're from Tel Aviv, there's a place in Tel Aviv. You know, so not everyone's buried there, but It's the major place. That's where all of the ceremonies
are
official. That's where the ceremonies are held. Yeah. What do you want to say?
I heard that Theodor Herzl, everyone's all these great things, but I also heard he wanted to convert all the Jews to Catholicism.
I mentioned that earlier, that at one point in his life, he thought that the way to stop anti-Semitism is mass baptism. He himself, never circumcised his kids. Jews, they weren't Jewish. His wife wasn't Jewish. He had a Christmas tree, he was like that. And the Dreyfus trial changed him. And he, when in his eyes, the most cultured country, instead of just being upset at who they thought was a traitor, even though it turns out he was, he wasn't a traitor, was someone else, and they were yelling, "Kill the Jews," he realized that Jews are not safe in Europe, and then he stopped working tirelessly through himself to Zionism. He didn't start it. There were already these Zionist groups. He just joined it and became its leader because of his charisma and his connections. So he joined what was already, had already begun.
If there was no Theodor Herzl, would there be a chance there would be Israel today?
Maybe not. Maybe not. He pushed it all the way through. He had the first Zionist conference in 1897 in Basel, and he said, he wrote in his diary, "Here I formed the Jewish state. It might take 5 years, it might take 50, but it'll happen." 50 years later, he had the partition vote in the United Nations for a Jewish state. Was it prophetic? I don't know. This is what he said. Right? He worked towards it. He left no stone unturned. He went to the Pope. He went to Kaisers. He went to kings. Pope. Whatever. He went all over trying to do what he could do. Yeah. Would you ask? Someone else want to say something? Okay. Now, there have been many different events that tore the country apart. Most recently, you had the disengagement, kicking out the Jews from their homes in Gaza, where you had people on both sides feeling very strongly. Before that, you had the murder of Yitzhak Rabin. Before that, you had the negativity towards how the government dealt with the Yom Kippur War. But the event that really, was about to tear the country apart happened right away in the beginning. And that was the German reparations affair. Okay, what is this? This is one of the most stormiest affairs in Israel's history. You want to ask
what was it? What was the thing, 879 for the Basel Accords? What was it?
There was the first Zionist conference. It was in Basel, Switzerland. You had delegates from all over the world. And had speeches and discussions about how they want to, start a Jewish homeland in Palestine.
1897.
50 years later, it was 1947.
Yeah.
Now, what happens? The government decides that they're going to take money from Germany, reparations, and Menachem Begin, who is in the opposition, he's not a member of the government. He and Ben-Gurion did not get along at all. We spoke about once before the Al-Talena. What happened to the Al-Talena? Menachem Begin brought all of these weapons for Israel to use in the upcoming battle that's going to be with the Arabs with the War of Independence. And Ben-Gurion refused to let him take 20% of it for his Irgun fighters and fired on the ship. Yitzhak Rabin was the commander on the boat, on the beach. And they fired the ship, they sunk the ship. People say they tried to kill Menachem Begin. He was on the ship. People died. All the weapons sunk to the bottom of the sea. Depending on which side you're on, Ben-Gurion's a hero or is a villain. Okay, depending on which side of the fence you're on, Begin's a hero or a villain. But this was a huge thing, to the point that Ben-Gurion never referred to Begin in the Knesset by name. Begin was a Knesset for 29 straight years before he became prime minister. He had lots of things to say. Whenever Ben-Gurion would refer to him, he'd say, "The man sitting to the left of, whatever, Mr. Horowitz," in response to what he said. We'd never say him by name. So here, now it becomes huge. Let's just figure it out. 1951, the German consul is a guy named Konrad Adenauer. He was not a Nazi. He's now running the country, and he offers reparations. Okay? He wants to offer money to the fledgling state of Israel, sort of as a kapara for what Germany did to the Jewish people. Okay? The country is in dire need of money. We just said from 1948 to 1951, it more than doubled in size. Okay? There's need for food, for housing, for jobs. Israeli bonds that many of your parents might have bought, that began in 1952 afterwards, and then $50 million, which helped, but it was not enough. And Germany comes in now, and they're offering a lot of money. Okay? Do you take it? So, what arguments do you say? Make the argument for no. That was Menachem Begin's thing. No, we won't take the money. Why not? Elliot, why don't you take the money?
If you say this money, like, it's just an easy excuse for why. Like, there's no, nothing will help what they did to us.
Good. Right? It's blood money. But also, you pay us off. How much does a Jewish life cost? Right? So you're just going to give us money and it's all better? Menachem Begin's family was killed in the Holocaust. And he said, you can't sell our honor and our dignity for money. We're not going to take your money to let you feel better. This is Menachem Begin, who's a great orator. And he had the people riled up. Menachem Begin was outside the Knesset. The Knesset was on King George. So you see now they're sort of building some sort of museum of where it was. You see all these billboards and stuff like that. The Knesset then was tiny. Okay? The building was tiny. The street was packed with people. Here's a picture of the people here, just like lined in the street. Okay? The police came, and the police are shooting, like, you know, all sorts of gas stuff. The people throwing rocks, they broke the Knesset windows with rocks into the building, right? Each one, Begin and Ben-Gurion, each one calling the other one hooligans. And Begin is saying, I said at Altalena that we should not fight back. We will not have a civil war. But today I'm saying, yes, we will have a civil war. We're not going to take German money, right? And he had the people going crazy. Altalena was the ship that I said that Ben-Gurion sunk. So Begin is calling on the people to resist, and they're fighting. Right? It was on January 9th, and thousands of demonstrators tried to break through. In the end, 200 demonstrators were injured, 100 policemen were injured, there were several dozen that were arrested. What's the argument to take the money?
Money is money.
What?
Money is money.
Money is money.
Yeah. I said a time of need, which was a big time of need, in Israel, like, I don't think that's actually, like, who cares how they feel? It doesn't make a difference how they feel. Like, if they're giving you something, like, you need it right now. Like,
It's also not that many allies at the time.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so Ben-Gurion's argument is, you want to say something, Ariel? Ben-Gurion's argument is, we need the money to prevent another Holocaust. Right, we're surrounded by people who want to kill us. We need money to start building up the state. He goes further. Ben-Gurion was very learned. Okay? So he says in Sefer Malachim, what did Eliyahu say to Achab? Ratzachta v'gam yirashta? Well, you killed and you took his field. What about Naval? You killed and you took his field? It's not enough that Germany was responsible for the death of 6 million Jews, but they overconfiscated all the property. What right do you have to the property of the 6 million? You killed and you're going to take it? You plundered, you pillaged Jewish assets, and therefore it is it's rightly our money. And it's not compensation. You hear the argument? What's Begin's response? That would all be good if you gave it to the survivors. Yeah. If you are taking money from Germany, giving it to the survivors of the Holocaust, then I have no problem with them getting it. But right now, for you, the state of Israel, to take their money, it's morally reprehensible. Right, what right do you have to do this? Ben-Gurion felt, it was what Eliot said, practicality wins out over morality. And if right now we need it, then we need it. I feel that if I would have been there at the time, I would have sided with Begin, and now 7 years later, I feel like bigger in this course, right?
Taking money, right?
Yeah. Like I feel now, like I feel that I probably would have also fought with my heart, which is much easier to do when you're not in a position of power. You know, some prime ministers have this great line. Ariel Sharon once had this great line. How did he all of a sudden do an about face when he became prime minister? Then all the things he, you know, stood for when he was not a prime minister. And his line was, what I see from here, I couldn't see from there. Right? Sometimes you have a different vision of things when the buck stops with you. So I think it's easier for Begin to say, let's not take the money. He wasn't the one responsible for the fledgling state. Hey, I don't know what he would have done if he would have been. Could be that he would have been, he was a very proud Jew, and watching his whole family get killed in the Holocaust might have said, take your money and, you know. It's quite possible he would have said that. But, like I said, I think that my heart would have been with Begin, but my mind now is saying that Bingering was right. Now, Begin called on the religious parties to side with him. He, like, says, don't you guys agree with me? Wouldn't we take money from Amalek? So what's the religious party's response? We took money from Egypt when we left. This was Parsha.
That's right? A Jewish response.
Now, again, the difference is there the Jews themselves suffered in Egypt. Okay, here, Israel's deciding, they're appointing themselves the representatives of the victims to take the money.
If they are the Jewish state, they should be.
I get that. And this is what Bigerin would argue. But I'm saying it's not the exact same thing. Now, money went, among other things, to help build a national water carrier, highway improvement, railway station, metal productions. One thing that we can say for sure is that Germany got off too easy. It was a one-time payment of $1.5 billion, which even by today's standards, value would be $13 billion. It's about $3,000 per survivor. And they left assets and stuff like that. Way more, forget about the loss of life. So, did we need it? Yes. Did it help us? Yes. What we probably should have done was gotten one of these every 10 years, we get another supplement. Like one of those type of payments, and
not just one time,
now it's all over.
I feel like Germany wouldn't agree to that.
I could be. Could be. The vote went, you showed very close. 61 to 50 in favor, and in the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee, it was 8 to 7. One swing vote in favor of authorizing this. But like I said, this was a major, major.
So right now, there was Frank Gore who was going to be prime minister.
At that point, Begin was prime minister. There's nothing to talk about. He was prime minister. Begin was a Knesset member. And he was leading people in a rebellion against what the government wanted to do.
It's because of a stupid thing.
It's not a stupid thing.
No, I'm talking about from it. I don't know, I hear it fine.
I'm just saying, like.
It's not stupid, but it's very, like. No, I hear it fine.
Say, like, when I first came to Israel in the 70s, all the buses, they still are, and all the cars, the cabs, they were all for Mercedes.
Still on.
Well, not the cabs, but all the buses.
In hindsight, it's sort of
some of the cabs at the time.
Some of the cabs.
I was in a really nice Mercedes.
I guess I was
old
for
the
same
now.
What? I see
your point. No, from the point of view now, it's
now
seems
like
they would take money.
Yeah, like. But
except there are certain things that you have to say, I have pride.
No, but it's not like you taking the money is saying it's okay what they did. I don't see it that.
I don't know. My family.
It's okay what we did.
Like, it's not like. Okay, you're giving us reparations, you're giving us money, compensation. I feel like that's not really saying it's okay we did it, but pay us back what we did.
Okay, I'm just saying. But Begin would say, this is blood money.
Yeah, people view it differently. Like, my family will never drive a German car.
Right, my son, I have a son, that in Israel, a lot of people, they travel by hitchhiking.
Right.
So when I drive my car to Nevi Daniel, I stop at what's called a trempiano, like a hitchhiking post at night, take people back. So I have a son that he would never get in a German car. And it didn't matter, he's in high school, he's waiting there, he can be waiting for half an hour, it's freezing cold, it's raining, And if someone comes by in a German car, Jewish person, right? And I'll say, no, thank you. We won't even get in it. We won't even get in it. So your family's like that.
Yeah. But do you have a cat?
No. I don't know.
He
wouldn't do it. He wouldn't buy anything German. Like, he felt like this is it. My father was sort of like that as well.
Yeah.
Right? I didn't get Adidas sneakers, you know.
Wait, you're right. Adidas is wrong.
You know,
the father likes that. I don't know. It's not, you know.
You got lost. At my parents' wedding, I think, like, my uncle was wearing a Hugo Boss suit, and my grandfather was really upset.
Yeah, so I'm saying, so there are people that, you know, they sit there and say, the people that are doing it now, they're many generations later. Okay. You know, the truth is, if you want to go, it just matters how good your memory is, because that basically every country...
Right.
You know, has had pogroms against Jews and expulsions against Jews. You know, maybe
it's not gonna
I think
last
like
forever.
All of Europe, I think maybe Sweden didn't do anything.
Right.
Well, you know, basically every other country did. So you can't buy anything.
Right.
I feel like with a German car, you're giving them money for the car. Like, you're giving them something in return with the reparations. You're not giving them anything in return.
It could be.
Right.
Could be, let you know. There's some parents that told me they didn't want to send their kids to Poland because why should we give Poland money for their economy? Because the trip. You know, you're staying in Polish hotels, using Polish buses or whatever. You stayed there.
It was Germany.
Without the collaborators, Hitler would not have been able to do what he wanted to do.
Yeah, yeah, but like,
he had willing.
The Polish were worse than the Germans.
Yeah,
the Polish guy too.
Yes, I know. But without the willing collaborators, Hitler would not have been able to accomplish what he did. Fact. They're now saying no.
Before the war even started, Polish people were killing Jews left and right.
Yeah, when Hitler came around, this was like, great.
Yeah.
You know, he's doing our dirty work.
He was just finishing.
So why did he kill 1.5 million Poles?
There were some people that fought against it. Yeah, Polish resistance.
Why do you have gypsies?
Yeah.
No, it's different. They're helping him out.
They resistance. Look, he conquered Poland. So there was a Polish resistance movement. That's what they're fighting against. They don't do anything to protect the Jews.
I didn't want to get...
There were righteous Gentiles. I don't want to say no Poles. There were righteous Gentiles.
Yeah.
Okay? And we honor them in Yad Vashem. But there are a lot more collaborators than righteous Gentiles.
Right.
Okay. Next thing I want to talk about, a very cool thing. And it's cool too. I mean, I think it's cool you might be a Pole because you may be very liberal. But... what's cool is I once taught this, and one of the guys said, oh my God, my dad was in this. Whatever. Like, so now I'll tell you. Unit 101. Unit 101 is the precursor to the Seret Matkal. And it was a secret unit. Okay, terror in Israel in these early years was ubiquitous.
So his dad was in this unit?
Yeah.
That's cool.
That was much older.
That's cool.
He was like much older. Now, terror was ubiquitous. Infiltrators blew up buses and restaurants, and Israel felt the need to respond in kind and strike fear to act as a deterrent, the way the Irgun had done earlier, you know, in the pre-state time, to the British. And now they wanted to do this to the Arabs, have some sort of reprisals that would prevent them from doing it, make them think twice about doing it again. This had to be kept secret so there would be plausible deniability by the government. Sort of like a lot of secret black ops units that every country has. Yeah. Now, Major General Moshe Dayan was the head of the IDF operations branch, and he initiates and establishes this secret unit. It's known in Israel, it's known as Hayichida. In English, it's called Unit 101. And it was to carry out retaliation missions behind enemy lines. So Dayan once was quoted about this saying, We cannot ensure that no water pipe will be sabotaged, no tree uprooted. We cannot prevent the killing of workers in the field or families in their sleep. We can make our blood very expensive. Right? This was the idea. Not to say Dam Yehudi, you know, Hefker. Just kill the Jews. No. You're going to kill Jews? It's going to cost you. He tasks Major, at the time, Ariel Sharon. He appointed him commander of this unit. The unit was established against the backdrop of, like I said, deteriorating security situation. Now, in one of the best known operations, which took place in October of 1951, Unit 101 attacked the village of Kabia in the Shomron. This was after, in response to a young mother and child being savagely killed. Now, this had been a launching pad for terrorist operations. A unit overran the village and blew up houses, not knowing that dozens of civilians were hiding in the houses. Right? They destroyed homes, including a mosque. Some 70 people, mostly women and children, were killed in the blast, and the operation caused a major storm in Israel. It was followed by an international condemnation. Prime Minister Ben-Gurion announced that the operation wasn't carried out by the IDF. Who did it? The Israeli border villagers could no longer tolerate all the sabotage, all the terrorism. They took the law into their own hands. Once again, the Israeli government, you know, blaming it on the settlers. Nothing's changed. Blame it on the settlers. You know? So he said, oh, what are we not going to do? Anything? They just couldn't take it anymore. Now, it resulted in great tragedy. It sparked domestic debate about the retaliation operations. Ben-Gurion, it's very interesting because often we sit there and say Ben-Gurion, he was like left-wing. He was labor. But you should know, at that time, left-wing was more right than the right-wing that we have today. Okay? And Ben-Gurion favored an iron fist policy, and he had to have countermeasures to make a point. No terrorist act would go unpunished. So, here, listen to this one, Yosef. After one mission, 1955, okay. Sharon leads a raid on Gaza. Okay, Gaza at this time is Egypt. Okay? Kills 42 Egyptian soldiers, carried back 8 dead Israeli soldiers. Sharon tells Dayan the mission was fully completed, but the price was high. Dayan responds, "The dead are dead, and the living live." Sharon writes in his memoirs, in one brief, harsh sentence, he summed up the realistic message of Zionism. There will be a price to be paid for a Jewish state, and we have to be willing to make that sacrifice. So you should know, the world media condemned the raid because they were upset about the difference in casualties, 42 to 8. So the stuff that goes on today, right? So that's what bothered them. Who would have been closer? You know, 42 to 8, that's crazy. Like, how could it be like that? So, but this is what Diana's saying. The dead are dead, and we bury them, but they protect the lives of the people who are living. And this is the price that has to be paid. Yeah?
How big was the unit?
Not sure. It was small.
Yes, I feel like even like 8 people is a huge price. Small.
Yeah, definitely a small unit. 100%. Yes?
Well, I don't understand, like, in 48, like, how was that all these Holocaust survivors all of a sudden are fighting a huge Israeli war and just...
Okay, it's not just Holocaust survivors. There were people that have been in Israel already from before. There's a first day, a second, a third. There's people that were already before. You had people that, not Holocaust survivors, that were already in their gun, Lehi, they were fighting against the British. You had people that were not Shomer, Haganah, Palmach. All of this happened before. Okay? You had volunteers that came, people who fought in World War II, Jews who fought in World War II, Jews who fought for America and Britain. Came over, and you had pilots, we not pilots, you had pilots that came over and fought. There's a documentary, I have it on the disc, I didn't show it on the bus, but I had it on the bus, called Above and Beyond, Steven Spielberg's sister. Okay, Steven Spielberg's sister, I have it, I'll bring it to you, if you have any place to put it in. Or you can just download it. Above and Beyond is what it's called.
Oh, that's a good
one. She interviewed these American pilots who, after World War II, came and fought for Israel. Because they didn't have pilots. Right? And they came over. So people said, you know, my brother needs me. And they came over. So the Holocaust survivors weren't trained soldiers. So they did a basic type of training and were sent out. Because we just needed soldiers. Sometimes we had more soldiers than guns also. We had little ammunition. We had little guns. People went out and did the best they could. But everyone fought. As I said, men, women, children, even crazy to think about it, yeshiva guys. Yeah. Yeah, they went and they fought. When we go to Har Herzl, so you'll see one of the places It's like this like sort of tunnel of people that died in the old city when they were fighting in 1948. And you'll see, like, there's just plaques. Not covering the plaques, names, some kid 9 years old, some kid 13 years old. Why? Because everyone got involved. Can you be a runner and bring a message from this place to another place? Everyone was involved. And carrying a gun, but he's running and delivering messages. Maybe he's even delivering weapons. There were, you know, the people, everyone was involved. This is a fight for survival. Right, you follow that? Now, the most decorated soldier in the history of Israel is Ehud Barak. Okay? And he was the head of Sir Nakal, and he goes on to become the chief of staff and later prime minister. Before him, the most decorated soldier, the person he never heard of, but he never went into politics, Meir Har Tzion. When I first heard of him, and I was like, me, I went up to my kids, and I go, they all know who this. Of course. Like, you know, they all, of course. He, Moshe Dayan, referred to him as the greatest soldier that we've ever had since Bar Kokhba. That's what he said. He's like a born leader. Meir Har Tzion, his real name was Horowitz, but everyone Hebraicized their names, was one of Israel's greatest warriors. Many things we take for granted today in the IDF are because of him. The old phrase, Acharai. What's Acharai? Follow me. After me. The officer, commander, doesn't sit in war room and send out his soldiers. He says, follow me. And he leads them in battle. Okay? Never leave a man on the battlefront. He was fearless. He ran many times to save soldiers in the battlefield. He, crazy things. You had like a whole sniper's nest. So he, by himself, would rappel into this and take out all of the snipers. Okay? He did this by himself. In 1956, he almost died on the battlefield after being shot in the throat. An emergency tracheotomy saved his life. But the war left him with a mangled left arm. But that didn't stop him from volunteering in both 67 and 73. The guy can't hold a gun. All right? What did he do? He took out a sniper with a hand grenade. And he performed the function of running into the battlefield to lift with his one good arm and carry injured soldiers off the battlefield. That's what he did. Israel needs me. He's there. Now, earlier, before he got injured, this is a crazy story. It's biblical. It's Shimon and Levi. He was particularly close with his younger sister. His parents got divorced, and he was sort of like, he was a big brother for his sister. He took care of her. And she and her boyfriend wanted to go near the Dead Sea when they were savagely attacked, raped, and mutilated. It took days till they began to even find the body parts. He retired from the IDF, because he knew that as a soldier he couldn't do what he's about to do. Took a couple of his buddies from Unit 101, and they kidnapped 6 Bedouins from the tribe that perpetrated the attack. He killed 5, and he tied one guy's hands behind his back, pinned onto his chest a note that said, I killed 5 for the 2 that you killed. Never heard from him again. As Sharon wrote in his autobiography, the Bedouins understood.
With one hand of this?
And did he get...
No, this was before he...
He got in trouble for that?
So now, Jordan, whose territory he violated when he went in and kidnapped these Bedouins, they complained, but Ben-Gurion did nothing. Which would never happen today.
Yeah.
Today, that would never happen. He brought up a murder. I mean, he had no evidence that the 5 people he killed were the ones that did anything to his sister. He just knew that it was from this Bedouin tribe. And he did this. But again, Ben-Gurion, I said the left-wing politicians were more right-wing than today's politicians. We'll stop here. All right.
Ben-Gurion was